On this episode of This Week in Space, we're talking new space entrepreneuring with Charles Miller. Stay with us.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is This Week in Space, episode number 64, recorded on June 2nd, 2023. The original Space Buccaneer. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by Bitwarden. Get the password manager that offers a robust and cost-effective solution that drastically increases your chances of staying safe online. Get started with a free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Space, the OG Space Buccaneer Edition. I'm Rod Pyle, Editor-in-Chief of Ad Astra Magazine, and I'm here with the inexpressible Sir Tarek Malik, Editor-in-Chief of Space.com. Good day, Sir Malik.
Hello. Hello, Rod. Welcome back from ISDC. I hope you had a great trip out there
to Texas. I did. I was in Frisco, Texas, next to Dallas, and did 7 or 8, I've lost count, presentations in 4 days. So I was very glad to come home.
That is a lot of space to be talking about.
That is a lot of space between my ears. So today we are joined by Charles Miller, New Space Wunderkind. I think I can call you that. Serial entrepreneur, former NASA senior advisor and transition team member. And we're going to talk about the rest of your resume because it's really long and it reads like a dream team listing. Charles, thanks for joining us today.
Welcome. Great to be here, Rod.
Thanks so much for coming. But before we begin, close your ears because we have a new space dad joke. It's not specifically space, but it relates, and you'll soon see why. Hey, Tarek.
Yes, Rod.
Why did the Boeing electrical engineer install a knocker on his door?
I don't know, Rod. Why?
Because he wanted to win the Nobel Prize.
Oh, no.
Oh, I got crickets today. Okay, how about
painful.
This?
It's
how about this? Because he wanted a valve that worked.
Okay. We're going to get right into it then, right?
I guess we are. Okay. Well, as always, we invite all you good listener folks to join Malik's Marauders and send us your best or worst space joke. We use them all. We give credit. That one was generated by me, so no credit for that on a whole bunch of levels. And don't forget to do us a solid. Make sure to like, subscribe, and all that good podcast stuff because we love you. All right. On to headlines. Speaking of Starliner.
Speaking of Boeing, yes.
I like to call this one the stuck Starliner. Boeing's first crewed launch of Starliner is delayed again after safety issues. When you told me this, Tarek, I kind of couldn't get my head wrapped around it. Flammable wire wrapping tape.
Yes. Yes. Hundreds of feet of it. By the way, yeah, this is pretty hot off the press. You know, NASA and Boeing sent out an announcement actually yesterday as of recording in the afternoon to say, hey, everyone, we're going to have a press conference at 4:30 today. So when they have a last minute press conference at the end of the day, you know it's bad.
And then they're hoping nobody will be there, right?
And then they delay it till 5 o'clock. And the TLDR is that Boeing has basically called off the Starliner launch on an Atlas V, which was scheduled to launch two astronauts, the first crewed flight up to the International Space Station on July 21st. And it's been delayed for years. First, because, of course, their first uncrewed test flight didn't reach the right orbit to get to the space station back in 2019. That's 2019. That's like 4 years ago. Because they just kept pushing, they had to refly that flight. They did it again in 2022. And then they keep pushing the crewed flight back and back. And now, last week, Boeing says, they discovered that all of the tape, this protective tape that wraps the wiring harnesses to keep them secure and, you know, from bumping and grating on the stuff around them on the spacecraft is flammable. And, you know, it's weird. They didn't know that was a risk when they flew the first time because it's the same tape that flew on the last two missions. But now they know it's flammable and they have to figure out if they can cover that up with another non-flammable type of material or if they have to rip all of it out and replace all the wiring. So that's one delay. The other delay, which is a little bit more problematic, is that they found out that these soft links, which I had to look them up what they are, they're in the parachute system, and they kind of connect or serve as anchors between the tethers that anchor into the capsule and the 88 lines of suspension lines that go to the actual canopy of the chute itself. That when they did their initial testing, apparently they made a mistake in how they noted the load limits of these really crucial parts of the parachutes. And in fact, the load limits were lower than what they thought they were, which means that in the case of an accident, like let's say they only have two parachutes out instead of the three on Starliner, the two parachutes would not be able to carry a Starliner down safely. So there would be a failure, which is, again, kind of late in the day, you know, as you're a month away from your first crewed flight to find this issue. And now just to one point, that last test flight, they rated that parachute as for safety to the public, not safety to a possible crew. So the parachutes were always a long lead on this crewed flight. But it is enough that they are standing down, not just like a delay, not a few weeks, not a month, indefinitely. You know, there's a window to launch this mission, maybe in the fall. If they can get all of these things done, they might have to re-qualify their parachutes, whatever new parachutes they decide to use, whatever this new wrapping is for the tape, for the wiring. So it'll be, I think, kind of tight if they get off the ground this year at all right now is what the mood was in that one. So sorry for the long news item. It's a lot to kind of take in.
That's okay. We'll shorten the other two. So Charles, being a long-term space professional, sorry for the snark here, but might you have thought of maybe carrying around a pack of matches and waving it around going in your spacecraft?
This is just unbelievable, guys. Can you guys remember back a decade ago that the U.S. government wanted to give Boeing a sole source on commercial crew? Can you believe that? Where would we be today? We'd be completely dependent on the Russians while Boeing was like having these problems. Russia would be in Ukraine. What would have that done to the U.S. foreign policy where we're begging Russia for a flight to the space station to save the space station and Boeing can't get its act together?
Yeah,
right. In fact, the fact that they didn't want to allow a new space company to do this. And like, can you think of, you know, 10 years ago, new space was a dirty word. It was a four-letter word. When I was at NASA headquarters, I swear if saying commercial was a four-letter word.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And Charles, as you point out, this whole announcement of this latest delay for Boeing comes like just days after SpaceX landed their second private mission to the International Space Station, their 10th crewed flight overall, and their third private mission just in overall too. So, you know, if you were going to place a hindsight bet, I think that we kind of know who would win.
You know, SpaceX is, you know, many years ahead of Boeing. And if you just remember, they were 40% less cost.
That's right.
Right. And they didn't have all these problems. So they're lower cost, they're faster, and they're lower risk. That is new space. New space is the future. And you know, we just all have to learn this. It's like this is critical to American competitiveness, world leadership, and the future of space. And like something we all know, but I'm hoping everybody else out there in the larger public is getting the same message.
Yeah. And to just one more point on that one about the cost, because NASA picked back in 2014 Boeing and Starliner to do these commercial crewed flights under a $6.8 billion total contract. Of that, Boeing's cost was $4.2 billion, just a bit shy of half of SpaceX's $2.6 billion. That's fixed cost. That means that all this stuff that Boeing has to fix, they have to cover one way or another, because NASA's paying just that $4.2 billion for the seven crewed flights that they've got planned, at least for now.
Yeah.
Okay, and before we move along, I just want to tell people who might not know, Charles has been singing the new space song for a long, long time, even before Boeing embarked on its 20-year crusade to reinvent the Saturn V with used parts. So, hats off to you, Charles.
I actually helped coin the term new space back almost two decades ago, so... It became a meme, and everybody said, I understand the difference that this means, and it's now the future. It's the core of how we're all going to get in space and how we're going to bring the benefits of space here to people on Earth. It's amazing the phase change we've had, including at NASA, including in the DoD. They're finally, everybody's is figuring it out that the future of space is a new space approach.
All right, moving on. The Betelgeuse bomb, Betelgeuse bomb. So Betelgeuse has been acting finicky for...
You said it three times. That means that he decades. Shows up, right?
That's right. And once again is surprising with us with some unusual behavior and could take us all out any moment now.
Yeah, that's not right. Really. This story comes, just like the last one. I wrote that Boeing story from space.com, but this one comes from Teresa Pulterova over at space.com, and I did see it at Scientific American by space.com alum Megan Bartels. Betelgeuse is the 10th brightest star in the night sky, and it's a giant star. And there was a lot of talk about it recently because while it goes through this periodic brightening over time, just recently it got super dim and everyone was like wondering, like, what's the deal with it? And now scientists that track its brightness are saying that it's been brightening up a little bit more over and over again, about 140%, I think, of what its normal brightness is. So it's in the 7th spot now instead of being the 10th brightest star in the night sky. And so the question is this a new sign that this star that's on the cusp of exploding is going to blow up? Now, these old things happen really, really slowly, but it's just exciting to kind of see, will it, won't it explode? And there have already been two studies, one that says, oh my gosh, this is like, it's going to blow up now. And other scientists saying, no, you're using the wrong terms and it's not going to blow up, but we're going to have to wait and see. But, keep your eyes up in the shoulder of Orion. It's a red giant star that's up there and it could get super bright if it blows up, visible in the daytime.
All right. And last coming, my favorite, Stars on Mars from space.com and other outlets. With its eclectic cast of 12 celebronauts, all clad in slick space suits and so on and so forth. So in a groan-worthy, ever-widening expansion of the analog astronaut phenomenon, which I have questions about myself. We'll wait till we have Pascal Lee back on because we love to grind on that. We have a new TV show. And mind you, this is there's a piece Dwayne Day wrote, I think, in Space Review. I think it's the 14th of these shows that kind of tried to get going on record. There's probably at least 30 of them. I mean, when I was still working at Discovery or with Discovery Production Company, this was pitched a number of times and never managed to grow roots. But now we have a show with a bunch of quasi-famous people stuck in a fake Mars habitat, pretending they're going to Mars. And of course, as a story editor, quote, on board, unquote, to make sure that there's continuous conflict and humor. What do we think?
Well, this is coming to Fox. By the way, this all comes from Fox TV.
Quality television.
On June 5th, they launch a group of celebrities, or they call them celebronauts, to Mars with their host, William Shatner. I'm not kidding you, in Mission Control. This is fun. How realistic it actually is going to be, I think we're going to have to wait and see. But the whole concept is you've got these celebrities. You've got Lance Armstrong. You've got Ariel Winter. You've got Ronda Rousey as well and others. And they're going to live in this mock Mars habitat in Australia near an opal mine. And they've got these nice spacesuits that they have to go out and do tasks and everything. And whoever does the greatest and doesn't get voted, I guess, back home or hopefully not out the airlock. that they'll win a trip to space. And that we've seen that kind of reality show before. Remember that Mir, space station concept a while back?
Space Hero. Don't forget that.
That's right. In Space Hero. But this, we know that there's actual rides that they can buy, with Axiom Space, SpaceX, Virgin Galactic, etc., on these flights. So there's a path to actually get to space. But I think at the base level, it's going to be fun. Probably not the most scientific. The trailer shows them clearly taking their helmets off outside of the capsule or the habitat. But that's launching. That's actually a thing. It's going to happen, and people should keep an eye out for it.
And in the background off the books, I just saw a text from our single-minded producer, Aunt Pruitt saying sports in space in all caps because he seems to think that's more important than the stuff we do here. Humph. All right. We're going to be right back with All About Charles Miller All the Time as soon as we take the short break to hear a word about Bitwarden. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by Bitwarden. Bitwarden is the only open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, at work, or on the go, and is trusted by millions. Even our very own Steve Gibson has switched over to Bitwarden. With Bitwarden, all the data in your vault is end-to-end encrypted, and not just your passwords. Protect your data and privacy with Bitwarden by adding security to your passwords with strong, randomly generated passwords for each account. You can go further with the username generator and create unique usernames for each account or even use any of the five integrated email alias services. Bitwarden is open source with all the code available on GitHub for anyone to view, including you. This means you don't have to trust their word. You can see that it's completely secure. On top of being public to the world, Bitwarden also has professional third-party audits performed every year, and the results are also published on their website. This is open source security that you can trust. Bitwarden also launched a new Bitwarden Secrets Manager, currently in beta. It's an end-to-end encrypted solution that allows teams and developers to centrally secure, manage, and deploy sensitive secrets like API keys and machine credentials. Secrets Manager keeps those sensitive developer secrets out of source code and eliminates the risk of them being exposed to the public. Bitwarden needs developers to help test out the new Secrets Manager and provide feedback. You can learn more at bitwarden.com/secrets-beta. Share private data securely with coworkers across departments or the entire company with fully customizable and adaptable plans. Bitwarden's Teams organization option is $3 per month per user, while their enterprise option plan is just $5 a month per user. And individuals can always use the basic free account for an unlimited number of passwords, upgrade anytime to a premium account for less than $1 per month, or bring the whole family with the family organization option to give up to 6 users premium features for only $3.33 a month. At Twit, we're big fans of password managers. Bitwarden is the only open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, on the go, or at work, and is trusted by millions of individuals, teams, and organizations worldwide. Get started with a free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. That's bitwarden.com/twit. And we're back. So, Charles, I think it's appropriate. I really do want to go through your history and space advocacy movement, and so forth. But we probably should start with what you're doing now, which is incredibly exciting. It's called LYNK, L-Y-N-K. And this is, as you'll describe better than I will, a really novel and probably world-changing system to allow any cell phone to talk directly to satellites. Is that right?
That is correct. We've, in the not-too-distant future, you're going to stay connected everywhere in the planet, no matter what, with just the existing standard mobile phone in your pocket. And we invented cell towers in space, and it's rolling out, starting service this year.
So you actually build and launch your own satellites?
Yes, we have. We built 9, launched 8. The first 5 are prototypes, and 3 are. We have the world's only commercial licensed satellite cell towers in space today. There's 3 of them. We're planning to launch a lot more and roll this service out to the world. And when I say service, I mean the phone in your pocket of every listener today that you have in your pocket will connect to our satellites today. And when we get enough up, you'll have broadband everywhere direct to your phone. And that may be, I'm sure there's listeners out there that don't believe it, but we've already proven it. We're connecting thousands of people. We've done it on every continent on this planet. And we're testing in 24 countries. And we just signed our 34th mobile network operator contract, like a Verizon or AT&T or T-Mobile, their mobile network operator, signed their 34th contract this morning.
And you don't have to glue little fake plastic plants to your cell towers up there. That's pretty cool. And is there any part, so this is all in LEO, I presume. Is there any part of the world where this won't work, or is this truly global?
Well, It won't work deep underground. So,
thank you. No, I meant like, you know, northern.
We'll have a small number of satellites going to the poles, so it'll be everywhere on the surface of the Earth. So.
Dark.
Well, I'm just saying, I'm excited that I'll be able to get service in my kitchen, because that's like one of the most frustrating things is that I can go to the kitchen and I can't call anybody. I wanted to ask just about, so Link, we should say LYNK, the advantage of that connectivity goes beyond just me and my cell phone, right, Charles? It's not just folks that are just wanting to surf the internet. It's for folks that don't have that kind of connectivity baseline. And this can be a sea change for how they live their regular lives, you know, having access to consistent communications for everything from, education to medicine and all that stuff, in these remote, unconnected, maybe underserved parts of the world.
There's huge benefits around the world. There's more disconnectivity overseas in many emerging markets. But there's a lot of disconnectivity even here in America and middle America. People who live in cities and suburbs forget about, people out on the farm in remote communities, that they have a lot more disconnectivity. And, it's a big problem. About, 15% of everybody who has a mobile phone on the planet is disconnected right at this moment. Now, you might not 15%, 85% connectivity. That's pretty good. There's over 5 billion people with mobile phones on the planet today. Well, that's 750 million people right now are going, gosh, I wish I had a connection. And so there's billions of people who experience extended disconnectivity during a year. And so it's a big problem. And mobile connectivity, affordable mobile connectivity, has been shown to pull people out of poverty, to drive economic growth, and to save lives. So what we're talking about literally is a life-saving and life-changing technology breakthrough from space. And this is really literally using the space technology to affect the lives of billions here on Earth. And so this is I've been saying this for a while. This is going to grow to become the largest category of space satellite service in the world by far. And so let me explain why I am convinced this is true. First of all, there are three satellite services that touch the lives of billions. One is GPS. It's in every phone. But nobody pays for GPS. You get it for free. The U.S. Air Force and now the Space Force pays for the GPS system. You get it for free. It's built into your phone. You don't have to pay for it. Second, weather. Everybody uses weather. Most people on the planet don't understand that, well, the government funds the weather satellites and does the weather analysis and puts out the predictions of when it's going to rain and when it's going to storm and where the hurricanes are going to hit. Well, you don't pay for weather either, for weather predictions. You get it free on an app on your phone. Well, billions of people use that. It's for free. Mm-hmm. This is the one service. Billions of people are going to use this, and people pay for communications, right? So there's literally, we estimate about 3 billion people a year with a phone who will use this to cover an extended period, and probably another billion people who will use it. 4 billion people. That is a huge market, however you build it up. Even paying just a little bit for connectivity in emerging markets, it'll be affordable in emerging markets and wherever you are. So it's going to grow to be the largest category in the space business.
So I'm glad you were able to let us know about that, and I look forward to hearing more. But I want to jump tracks for a second, because I just want to make sure we get this question in. I was listening to you on David Livingston's space show. I think you were on last year.
I've been on David's show a number of times.
A dozen times, probably. David got a Space Pioneer Award at the ISDC this year, by the way. But
great for David.
Well deserved. But one of the things that you said that I think is really an important item to talk about was, in essence, NASA doesn't need more money. They need different plans. I think you were talking about the SLS, but more broadly just about the way they do business. Can you expand on that a bit?
Well, there's this mostly driven by the industrial complex, the big cost plus contractors. There's this mantra like, oh, we could do anything we want in space. You just give us more money. And if you take a serious look at how we do space and you did space differently, we actually have enough money in the NASA budget if we had control over how we do space to basically transform our entire national space agenda. We have a lot of money going into space. And my thesis is you fix how we do space first, and you then deliver tremendous results to the American people, and more money will come. But if you're just continuing, just like we were talking about, you know, the old space paradigm with cost plus and throwing money at the problem, it never becomes affordable. And the American people aren't stupid. They know this stuff is just extremely expensive. Spending $40, $50 billion on a rocket that's launched once, it's crazy. That's a rocket to nowhere, right? And so that's just, and most people in NASA know this too, but it's just, we're locked into this paradigm and can't let go. But it's the innovation of the American entrepreneur that is going to open up space and allow space to be used to benefit millions and billions of people and have millions of people living and working in space.
Well, just a quick follow-up, and I'm glad you touched on that. You know, you've worked at NASA. I've worked at NASA in a much lower category, but have worked there. And they're smart people. They're passionate people. They're driven people. They're mission-oriented people. They know which end is up. In general, I think they know what the best path forward is. But, you know, Congress is part of NASA, effectively, and they have a lot to say. And if you want to build a rocket in 44 of the states, then SLS is the way you do it. It's an expensive, inefficient way to do it that was driven by people like Shelby for years, who is fortunately no longer in service. But, you know, it's a tough nut to crack, and it's not spoken of loudly in the hall. I mean, JPL only is the place I work, but it's not spoken of loudly in the halls, but it is spoken of, and heads are shaken from time to time. So you're right. They certainly know.
Well, as long as we're scared to say the truth, we're never going to change the future, right? The truth is SLS is a rocket to nowhere. And until we can get a strategy that makes sense, you just accept that we're going nowhere. A lot of my friends are scared to say the truth. SLS is a rocket to nowhere. We're throwing away $3 billion a year, digging a hole, putting the money in it, burning it, and burying it, right? It's going nowhere. And, you know, the vast majority of people in NASA know this. The vast majority of people in NASA know that the future is low-cost, reusable access to space, frequent, low-cost, reliable access to space. The fact that we're not spending that money on leveraging the emerging reusable launch vehicle, revolution is insane. That there's a bunch of these commercial companies that want to build and accelerate reusable launch vehicles. And we've already helped one of them called SpaceX. We gave him a contract based on his big, rocket to go to the moon. But we haven't figured out how to partner with all the others, right? With Rocket Labs Neutron, with Blue Origin, with their reusable rocket. So there's others that we should be accelerating this. We should be building a propellant economy in space. It's built around propellant depots. We're starting to get there based on both the Blue and the SpaceX lunar landers, that they're all built around the propellant depot. That was a dirty word. When I was at NASA, I was the champion of propellant depots. I was just there for 3 years, but I stood up a team. And we were like the Rebel Alliance, right? And outnumbered. We were totally outnumbered from 2009 to 2012. And the people who I wasn't going there to have a career, so I would take all the risks and do what was right. But a lot of people got punished by being on the team I stood up for focus on propellant depots. And that all that work got buried, but it was the future and it's coming back. So it's like, okay, you could kill the idea temporarily, but it's the only path that makes sense in the long term.
You know, to follow up on that, because it's such a, like, in space refueling with those depots, I mean, that's integral to SpaceX's Starship plan. They launch one Starship up, they launch another one to refuel that one, then they go to the moon, and then they sustain that over time. And I guess the question I have is kind of taking a look at, like, what's happening now versus when you were, you know, trying to push those types of concepts, you know, at NASA, and ask, you know, what changed? Is it the fact that SpaceX was able to deliver when even, like, the government was not letting them, you know, use the pad they leased at Vandenberg initially, and they had to go to the Kwajalein Atoll way out in the ocean in those early days? Is it the fact that they kind of took that on the chin and then, you know, performed, maybe not on the timetable that Elon has always said he's famous for making a very ambitious timetables, we'll say. But you know, we just mentioned it earlier that they've flown 10 crewed flights. They launched a Starship and it didn't blow up on the pad.
They just had their 200th successful launch in a row.
That's right.
They're over 99% reliable, right? No, this is the most reliable launcher in the world now. It's short maybe of the Soyuz streak for a while, but it's amazing. So what has changed is there's a couple things that's going on here. One is there's a small edge case of 10% who are just bought in, like, to their empire building and their, you know, big budgets, and their future is built on running this big program, have this prestige, and they don't care about opening up space. Right. And they're very political. They're going to protect their empire. And then there's the crazy advocates like I was, who were like, the future is commercial space, commercial public private partnerships, all these new approaches, reusable launch vehicles, propellant depots, and leveraging commercial space and going faster, much more innovation. And those are the crazy on the other side. And there's the middle, it's probably 80%, the mass. And they were bought in. They were bought into the old paradigm that kind of just emerged very slowly and got more bureaucratic about how you do space. They were just used to it. And they were scared by new space. Now, if you go back to the original founders of Apollo, you talk to the older folks, the Chris Kraft, who was a great friend before he passed away. He completely got it that NASA was slow and bureaucratic and had lost the innovation they had that took us to the moon in less than a decade. But the people who grew up on it were just scared by it. And so they weren't used to it. It was new. Now, the proof is in the pudding. The fact that a commercial space company has proven there is a better way is shifting the dynamics of that broad middle, right? It hasn't got rid of the 10% who are still totally locked in and political and don't care, right? And are blocking progress and just want, you know, the jobs in their district, the jobs in their state, and that's all that matters. But the broad middle is seeing, like, there is a different way. This is the future. And they really do would like to be part of not wasting their career at NASA or in industry. And so, and the kids see it too. Yeah. Right. So the culture is shifting. You know, two decades ago, when you started a commercial space company, the first thing any investor asked was, well, what does NASA think of it? And then they called up their cousin at NASA and their cousin will say, well, this is crazy. And we're not doing it. This is too risky. Well, all of that changed. The culture here in America is changing. The new space revolution is winning. And across the board. So there's a paradigm shift going on right now. Now, the 10%, you're never going to convince them. They don't care, right? But you win the middle, and, you know, it goes in, you know, cracks and fissures where there's, you know, just jerks. So everybody's going to say, when is SLS going to die? I don't know, but it's going to die, and it'll happen quickly. It'll happen like the ASRM dying after Jamie Whitten, who was chair of appropriation, passed away in the House of Representatives. He's chair of appropriations. He had set up the advanced solid rocket motor program in Mississippi, and he had a heart attack or a stroke, and within a year ASRM was dead. But nobody could predict it. It's kind of like the fall of the Berlin Wall. suddenly it doesn't happen, and suddenly it happens very quickly, right? It's just and so the SLS will happen the same way. It'll be suddenly people will be saying it's not going to happen for years. And then it's suddenly, boom, it'll happen very quickly.
Well, we're going to be back to talk about the origins of some of this new thinking, specifically about space advocacy, as soon as we take this break to hear from our sponsor. So, Charles, I joined the NSS, National Space Society, in, I think, 1984 or something, sort of fell away from it and came back in the 2000s. But your name was mentioned frequently, among many other things, to do with March Storm, which is something that I think you were instrumental in creating and revived in about 2015. Can you tell us a little bit about that, what it means, what it's for, and your role in that?
Well, you started in 84. I got involved with what was called the L5 Society in 1982 when I was in college and became a space advocate. And that merged with the National Space Institute, became the National Space Society. I've for a while was the number two employee at National Space Society under Lori Garver. She was the executive director. And in the 90s, I decided what we needed to do was that was called the March Storm. I decided, the key insight was that, the people who were promoting what you do in space weren't promoting our vision of an open space frontier where millions of people living and working in space and all the benefits of space helping people here on Earth. It was big budget programs. It was whether it was science projects or the shuttle, and we realized the shuttle wasn't going anywhere fast. It had never been designed in hindsight, if you do study the history, to be truly reusable. It was sold as a reusable visionary project, but the people at NASA in the 70s quickly realized they couldn't get there. And rather than, they just sold it to, they needed a program, and it wasn't going to get there. And so I said, but that's what the space program we deserve, is opening space to benefit people here on Earth, millions of people, right? That and so that we were going to go to space. The O'Neillian vision, which captured me in college, and I said, I'm going to dedicate my life to that. And so in the 90s, I said the way to do this is we should go directly to the leadership of the people. It's in the Constitution. We can go to Congress and tell them what we want them to do. And so I started organizing trips to Congress by private citizens. The first one is the March Storm. It was just 9 people. And we created a $25 million program in 1995 for focusing on reusable launch vehicles and cheap access to space. And people were shocked, like 9 people in a week. Yeah. So the next year I had a program, a marketing theme. I said, is 1 week of your life worth $3 million? And joined me in 1996, in the March Storm. And we had 40 people. And then we passed the Commercial Space Act of 1998 that actually, in hindsight, was a huge breaking point. It forced NASA to buy commercial space station cargo delivery services, which a decade later in 2008 saved SpaceX from going bankrupt. Elon, if you read the histories, was a month from running out of money. And he got a call from Bill Gerstenmaier, head of human spaceflight, and Bill said it was December 23rd, 2008, 2 days before Christmas. He was completely depressed. He was a month from laying everybody off. He got a call from NASA, said, you've won a $1.8 billion contract. It saved SpaceX. And that then led directly to Commercial Crew and the whole revolution. So the visionaries in the space advocacy community who were part of the 80s and then the 90s have led directly to this revolution in space. And so that after I in the late 90s, after we had these breakthroughs, I started my first commercial company, and ProSpace and the March Storm had a few other major successes. But in about 2005 or 2008, it kind of lapsed and wasn't existing anymore. And then I said, after I got out of NASA, I said, one of the things I'm going to do is get that started again. So we got it jump started in in around 2013 or 14. Mm. And now if you would like to be part and have a piece of seeing the large-scale economic development and settlement space take place, the March Storm is a great place to jump in.
So just to continue on this theme for a second, I talked to a lot of groups of young people, and the sense I get, and this also came from a conversation with Susan Martin of the Mars Society a few years back, we were talking about space advocacy in general, and that the sense of young people, and when I say young, you know, maybe under 35 or 40, is, hey, you know, Elon and Jeff Bezos are doing it. We don't need to be advocates anymore. That's for those guys back in the 80s and 90s when nothing was happening. It's jumping now, so we can just sit back and watch the miracles occur. I suspect you don't think that's the case.
Well, I don't think that's the case at all. So, first of all, you know, you shouldn't be satisfied with just what that Jeff and Elon are doing, right? And depending on a few billionaires, until... If you need to be a billionaire to do a successful space company, that is not a successful free market space enterprise organization. You need to have people who are not billionaires start space companies and make money. That is when we've opened space and have the large scale economic development space, right? And so that there's a ton of things that need to be done. And opening space to millions of people living and working in space. It is a huge opportunity. It's very exciting. And I think the people who are inspired by this don't need to be persuaded to, you know, that they're going to sit back and watch. They're actually going to say, I want to be part of that. And they're going to jump in. And I see tons of young people. They come and work at Link who just want to be part of this. They want this to be about their lives. So if you're one of those people who just want to sit back and watch, well, you should sit back and watch your peers and colleagues and fellow citizens who jump in and make it happen.
Ooh, well done.
Well, I wanted to follow up because you make that point that it needs to be more than just the billionaires with their fancy space toys, you know, and then they get a NASA contract out of it to go to the moon or something to drive that industry forward. And I think a lot of today's generation, people that have been following the last 20 years of spaceflight, you know, where we've had a lot of social media, they can see how flashy Blue Origin and Jeff Bezos are, or SpaceX with their missions, with their giant rockets are. What is the future that you see then for the other companies, people who aren't billionaires but are looking to get into the industry, you know, one way or another? You know, I tell my daughter, when she's trying to pick something to do, that every industry has a lot of different layers. There's not just like what you see at the end result. There's all of these other things that have to happen in the background to make that industry possible. And you can have a role wherever you find a niche in that, I guess, that arrangement, that hierarchy, that you find, ecosphere, that's the word. And I'm curious, what do you see now, you know, for the non-billionaires, for people that should be looking to get into a sustainable business in space, you know, in the 21st century?
Well, first of all, the way to learn is by doing, right? You're not going to learn this in a book. And I see a lot of people jumping in with an entrepreneurial mindset. The problem is many of them are repeating the mistakes of the past. So first of all, I'd say study your history deeply, learn everything you can. You know, don't repeat old mistakes. You want to, you know, if you're a space entrepreneur, you want to make new mistakes. You want to discover things that people don't know, right? You don't want to repeat old mistakes.
Are there like three or four? Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but what is there like the same mistake you see getting repeated over and over again? Is there like three or four that you're always on the lookout for?
That's so obvious to everybody, you know, who had experience as a space entrepreneur was all the small launch vehicles, mm-hmm. right? The tyranny of small launch vehicle economics, there was just no way there was product market fit that this was going to happen. If you'd studied history, you'd say, well, why did Pegasus fail? Well, Pegasus was a low, small, cheap launch vehicle. It worked technically. There was no market for it. They were originally going to sell it for $6 to $8 million a launch, and they had one or two launches a year. And it kept on going up in price till it was $30 or $40 million a launch. And then it was launching once every 5 years. The Falcon, the SpaceX Falcon 1, is like is the, about the same capability as the Pegasus from Orbital. And if you'd studied it, well, if they got it working on the fourth launch, it was wonderful as a training vehicle. So in hindsight, I just wonder if, you know, I mean, I think Elon thought there was a market for it. So, but Gwynn is fessed up in a book. They figured out there was a market for 3 launches a year. That's not good.
Yeah.
And then they just retired it. So there was no reason to retire it if there was a market for it. And then all these companies jumped in and building small launch vehicles like the Falcon 1. Well, if there was a market for it, Elon wouldn't have abandoned it.
Yeah.
And so really thinking there was a market there, and then the investors who put money in it didn't understand. And so a lot of people who maybe didn't understand it. So it's really the tyranny of small launch vehicle economics. So there's examples of other things where you're repeating where people didn't study their history. It was discoverable. Like, you should have asked why did the Pegasus get retired? Why did the Falcon 1 get retired? Why didn't they keep doing it? Should I start a small launch vehicle company? There's many examples of this. And like every segment, there's like, do we need the 20th Earth Remote Sensing Company? What's different? So everybody, if you're doing there's a bunch of resources out there that are entrepreneurial, you can apply to space. Find out what is the problem nobody else has found. Read Peter Thiel's book, 0 to 1. He says, find a problem that is new, that nobody knows about. Find an insight, a secret that nobody knows about. If you're just doing the same thing of everybody else, like, you know, you're probably at best a commodity. So there, I used to teach a course to space entrepreneurs. So one of the things, find a secret, find a big secret that people don't know. And that's what Link did. Link found a secret at the start. Nobody believed that you could connect a satellite directly to a standard mobile phone. They thought that was impossible. Well, the secret was, you know, the gut instinct was wrong, that the physics show you can close the link two ways between a phone and a satellite. So that was the start of our startup. So I would advise anybody starting a commercial space company to do something similar.
So it's interesting when you talk about knowing your history, and I'm not sure this will be exactly on point, but as I watch the press, not space.com, Tarek, but as I watch the more generalized press.
No offense taken, Rod. No offense.
digest what happened with the first test launch of Starship is Super Heavy. Of course, the headlines were crazy Elon's rocket blows up and, oh, this is terrible and he's behind schedule and we'll never get there and all that. And anybody, and admittedly, most people haven't, but anybody who's done any kind of a moderate to deep dive into the history of the Apollo program, if you read about the development of the F1 engine, which for its time was a miracle, those guys at Rocketdyne very quickly realized you can't just scale up a little rocket engine into a big one. So they tested it to destruction over and over, went out in the test field, picked up the pieces, look at how they were bent and what happened. And eventually, they had a very smart inspiration. They were having acoustic instability in the engine and it was shaking itself to pieces and other things were going wrong. Well, they put a little bomb inside the combustion chamber, and at the right time upon startup, they'd set off their bombs so that they set up the acoustic instabilities and then they could track them down. And the thing was damn near perfect after that. Right. And it seems like there's something to be learned, which a lesson apparently Elon and his brilliant people learned very well, which is, look, if we're going to move fast, we're going to have to break things, as the saying goes.
In fact, if you analyze space development two ways, there's the company that goes rapid, do learn loops and breaks things and knows they're going to fail and then learns from every time it fails and then eventually gets there, versus the one who tries to analytically do everything perfect and takes years to do the first real test and then it fails and then they do it again years. Mm-hmm. Which one's cheaper? It shows the first approach is cheaper. The first, but it embarrasses you. It's the embarrassment. So going back before Apollo and the F1, the Atlas launch vehicle failed 12 times before it succeeded. 12 times in a row. Imagine the guts to launch, to keep going. And like they did test after test after test, and they did it fast. And it was a national security imperative to get this launch vehicle. It was for, you know, it was for ICBMs development. We needed to have rockets. It was critical, and they went fast. And because it was important, they didn't stop, and they got the Atlas launch vehicle out of it. But imagine that culture of a government agency actually did 12 failures in a row before they got the 13th right. That is innovation. That is the culture. You can have U.S. government agencies have that culture. NASA had it at the beginning. Mm-hmm. At the start of the space part of the U.S. Air Force had that culture, too. We just lost it.
Well, I would ask, though, like, do you feel that there is more flexibility, Charles, in the commercial space for that? Because, and you know, we've been talking about SpaceX a lot, but they're just a great example of leaning into that. What, you know, you mentioned, oh, yeah, a failure after a failure after failure can be embarrassing. And yet you have SpaceX, which after they blew up 4 or 5 rockets, made a video mashup set to music to say, look at our rocket, you know, our rockets explode, or look at all of our failed landings, you know, and then later on they achieve it. And it's, you know, it's great. They set it to,
right, and now startups, they have 200 in a row. So the acceptance of risk and failure and going fast leads to huge success. They now have 200 launches in a row without a failure. And it's because of this different culture for accepting risk that got them there. They never would have got to 200 launches in a row without having a different mindset on failure. Link has adopted the same thing. I've learned a lot from watching everybody and their approaches. And, you know, we've had a bunch of failures. We just don't have to talk about them. Same thing with DARPA. What most people don't understand about DARPA, everybody understands DARPA, this amazing organization that's invented all these breakthrough technologies, including the F1 engine that you mentioned, including the internet, including a bunch of other breakthroughs. And so what they don't understand is 5 out of 6 DARPA programs on average fail, right? It's the 1 out of 6 that are breakthroughs. So accepting risk, accepting failure is part of the strategy of breakthrough technology development.
You know, I was going to ask about your experience with DARPA and NASA, you know, in terms of leading to what you're doing now at Link. And just it was really going to be about risk tolerance and being ready for that. But it sounds like you've hit all of those points already on the nose there. I mean, are there like two or three really standout lessons either, you know, at DARPA or at NASA that are like tenets that you kind of keep your Link team on board with, you know, as you're going through the next launch, the next technology development project for the markets you're trying to get into?
Well, the insight here, I think, is DARPA continues to be a breakthrough technology developer. It's easy when you have one cultural mindset to keep people focused on that. NASA has a problem. They need to do both. They started out as the innovator, right? And so there's a culture that is in part, you know, failure is not an option, and that's appropriate in like mission and operations. You have human life. You do things a certain way. But if that culture goes over into your rapid, you know, technology development part of your organization, it kills the innovation. And somehow you need to separate it. NASA didn't know that, right? NASA has some of the culture of failure is not an option. And, you know, the part of the issue is the incentives are different and wrong. Incentives for working the government. If you have a breakthrough in industry, you get a big bonus, you get a, you know, stock options, you get a, you know, quick promotion. But, and if you fail, you know, like if you're in the right organization, they say, try again. What'd you learn from it? Did you learn something? If you actually fail, but it doesn't kill the company and you learn something, is do it again. What are you going to do different? Right. But in a government organization, they get congressional hearings. There is no bonus. There is no big promotion from the big breakthrough. It's very slow. So over time, the innovators, the hard chargers that you want to be leading on this, they're tired of this and they leave. So they self-select and leave, and your culture evolves over time to being, you know, much less risk tolerant. The people who are left behind, you know, the ones who want to do the risk since they got tired of banging against the wall leave. And the ones who are left are the slower. And so it's just a natural evolutionary process in organizations that we're struggling with.
So we're coming close to our wrap-up time here, but I want to ask, what are the next things we might be hearing publicly about Link? When can I get my subscription? And if you want to take a few more closing thoughts on how it's going to change the world, because when I think about what this means specifically to the third world, I mean, personally, I've got a boat. I don't want to spend $10,000 on all that expensive nav equipment, so I'm looking forward to buying your system so I could just use my cell phone offshore. But that's kind of a first world problem. I mean, you're going to be changing the third world with this, I think. Can you talk about that just a bit?
Well, there's huge benefits to mobile wireless. You know, the for people in emerging markets, the mobile phone in their pocket gives them access to all the world's information. It becomes a life-saving device. It becomes a huge productivity enhancer. People in and on small family farms and these, you know, they go into the town and they waste the whole day because who they're going in wasn't there, right? They build farm produce. Which town should you take it to? Who's going to give me the best price? They take it in and hope for the best. Rather than calling ahead, cutting a deal in advance, and this market is going to pay me more, I'll take it there, right? And just getting access is huge productivity enhancer. You get better deals. The farm economics goes up. So it's clearly showing in the data that it drives economic growth. It pulls people out of poverty, right? So it not only saves lives, but, you know, extending mobile wireless across the world is a fundamental breakthrough that is going to lead to driving economic growth for billions of people in particularly in rural remote communities where they have no connectivity. And it's going to save lives, right? So just like Apple is already saving lives, but everybody with a mobile phone in your pocket, and when you need help, you'll be able to call for it, right? That this is, that's why we make all our kids have a mobile phone, right? When it's not because we want them on the internet in school. It's because we want them to have a phone so they can call for help. And because we know we have find the iPhone, we can find out where they are, right? That's why we give all our kids the phone. It's a safety device. So we fundamentally know this, that this is the most important device in the lives of billions. And people are going to be connected everywhere in the future. So this is a really big deal for the, you know, human society.
Well, that's very exciting. And I want to thank everybody for joining us today for our chat with Charles Miller, one of the founders of NewSpace, and I guess the guy who coined the term. You should have trademarked it while you had a chance. There's gold in those hills. What's the best place online for us to track? I know we can go to the Link website and we'll post that. Is there
Make
anywhere
sure
else?
Everybody knows the Link website is lynk.org. Right. There's some other links, but you want to go to link.world. You can find, track us there. And we're on Twitter, and we're also on LinkedIn. If you like tracking there, we just sent out some news. We signed our 34th contract this morning, and had one of our M&O partners in New Zealand announced rolling out Link services in New Zealand this year.
And you also post the occasional policy piece on LinkedIn and other spots, right?
Well, it's hard to take the space the policy part out of the space guy, right? So, so obviously, based on this discussion, I have a few opinions. I'm not shy about sharing them when asked.
Well, and bless you for having them and giving them to us early enough that it made a difference. Tarek, where do we track you down?
Yes, well, you can find me at space.com as always, and on the Twitter at Tarek J. Malik. And this weekend, I'll be watching what will be, I believe, SpaceX's third big event of the week. That's the launch of the CRS-28 cargo mission to the International Space Station. I think they've got a Starlink one coming up too. They had a Starlink earlier this week. And I think also the AX2 landing. So lots of things happening. And the commercial space with SpaceX. So
very
checking
good.
That.
Well, thank you for that commercial for space.com. You can always find me at pilebooks.com and at astromagazine.com. Also available in a bookstore near you. I just saw it in Dallas on the rack up front. So kudos to us. Don't forget to drop us a line at twis@twit.tv. That's twis@twit.tv. We always welcome your comments, suggestions, and ideas. And so write us, because we return every email. And don't forget to check out space.com. The website's the name. And, of course, since Charles and I are both alumni, the National Space Society at nss.org. Both are good places to satisfy your spaceflight cravings. New episodes of this podcast published every Friday on your favorite podcatcher, so make sure to subscribe, tell your friends, and give us reviews. We like 5 stars and a thumbs up and whatever other kind of iconography they have. You can also head to our website at twit.tv/TWIS. And finally, don't forget, you can get all the great programming on the Twit Network ad-free at Club Twit, as well as some extras that are only available there, including, as you know, because I said it before, Tarek falling off his chair, because that was one of the highlights of my year, for just $7 a month. And that's a heck of a bargain. And finally, you can also follow the Twit Tech Podcast Network at Twit on Twitter and on Facebook and twit.tv and Instagram. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next week.
It's midweek, and you really want to know even more about the world of technology. So you should check out Tech News Weekly, the show where we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news.
It's the biggest news. We talk with the people writing the stories that you're probably reading. We also talk between ourselves about the stories that are getting us even more excited about tech news this week.
So if you're excited, well, then join us. Head to twit.tv/TNW to subscribe.